number one, I want to describe kind of how I come to this class and how I really think about the categories of Jewish thought. And for me, the kind of the central goal of this project is to create what Deleuze, the great French postmodern philosopher, called a line of flight, a two-way path of communication between the things that we hold dearest and most tenderly in life, our hopes and fears for our lives and what they will or won't mean or can and cannot mean, including what happens after we die, our sense of being obligated to others, sense to ourselves, certain sense to God and tradition, sense of what we know and don't know, can and can't know, must or have an obligation to learn, and on and on. All those questions that really sit at the heart of what it means to be a human being and a Jew. The questions that, if you're anything like me, kept you up till 3 a.m. many, many nights, especially maybe in the age of like kind of 16 to 24. And I would submit tend to be the kind of questions that the Jewish community does not always succeed in giving us a refined, accurate, analytically dexterous vocabulary or set of concepts to express ourselves, to understand others in, to parse our experiences and thoughts in new ways. And that is my number one goal for this these sessions, is actually to use the categories of Jewish thought, belief and doubt, which will be a session for today and may spill over into next week, law or obligation, miracles, revelation, the afterlife, as ways to better understand what it means to be a human being and a Jew, but primarily a human being. And secondarily, there's a kind of implicit claim, which at certain points will be explicit, that it is the fundamental questions and experiences and many times emotions of being a human being that are the right backdrop for formulating not just the questions, but even the ideas of Jewish thought. And what I mean by that, just to be really clear, is it is not analytic philosophy. It is not the history of ideas. It is not the text of the Torah, even, that is the backdrop against which the ideas of miracles, revelation, afterlife, faith, and doubt kind of are framed, right? The axes, the coordinate systems we're going to use are the coordinates of human experience. And I think the greatest recent articulator of this methodology was Peter Berger, the Lutheran sociologist of religion, and his book, in his short and wonderful book, The Heretical Imperative. I will share here, by way of this, just to give you a hint of the kind of thinking we're going to do. Berger has what I believe is the greatest title of any book that I know of, and it'll give you as good a picture of any of the terrain we're going to cover. The book is called A Rumor of Angels. And Berger says, I, as a sociologist, will tell you what a rumor is. A rumor is a truth claim that has the following three properties. First, it is neither consonant enough with the set of things we already know to be true that we immediately assimilate it as true, nor is it dissonant enough with the set of things we already know to be true that we immediately reject it as false, but it sits in a very narrow band of having important similarities and differences to the things we know to be true. You know, the human mind, we especially found this in the age of online disinformation, is very poor at holding a question mark over things that we've read or heard. So that's the first property that rumors have, right? They sit in a kind of zone of cognitive uncertainty. The second thing is that we cannot track down the source, the person who initially made the claim, to interrogate them as to whether they are a reliable reporter. And the third is we cannot independently verify the claim. We don't have access to the people. You know, a rumor, high school rumor, starts about what two students did one Saturday night. You don't know who, right? It doesn't sound exactly like them, but it doesn't sound crazy. That's claim number one. Number two, no one knows who started it. And number three, no one was there and there's no videotape. So Berger, after setting up this apparatus, then says to be a modern religious person, we might say a postmodern religious person, is to have heard a rumor of angels. Right? There's a claim that we're exposed to that there's a different plane of reality, something enchanted, something metaphysical, something magical, something beyond us. Number one, right, that claim is not totally consonant with our everyday experience, but it's also not totally dissonant, or maybe more importantly for Berger, there are parts of our lived lives that make that claim quite plausible, if necessary. Number two, we can't go back and ask Ezekiel, we can't, you know, what he saw. And number three, we don't, you know, as normal, simple Jews don't have access to those kinds of things. If you reject the rumor as false, just out of hand, you're an atheist, you're a Dawkins or something like that. And if you immediately just accept the claim as true, you're a religious person, but not a modern one. And then he kind of devotes chapters of the book to the different experiences of human life that make that rumor plausible. Theater, jokes, love, all make it plausible. So I wanted to share that just that's the kind of ethos of what we're going to do. Very much a Berger style project. That's number one. Number two is two, three, and four are all going to be common and I believe wrong ways, like deeply wrong, not just morally, but on some level, kind of philosophically, cognitively, to approach questions of belief in Judaism. So the first is here in this room, we do not believe in doxastic voluntarism. You don't either. You just don't know that you don't yet. So doxastic voluntarism, right? Doxastic means about belief, orthodoxy, correct belief, the doxology. Voluntarism meaning control. Doxastic voluntarism is the idea that you exercise some control over what you believe to be true. And doxastic voluntarism is false. For example, I will give $1 million to the first person on this call who succeeds in convincing themselves that the year is 1913. Try. I mean, maybe you can pull it off, but I haven't encountered anyone who can yet, right? And doxastic voluntarism is a term in the history of philosophy that's like relativism. No one has ever described themselves or anyone they like as a doxastic voluntarist. It is only an insult that is hurled at one's opponent. And, you know, okay, William James made the bad call of, you know, naming one of his essays, The Will to Believe. Bad idea in these terms. But, I may want to believe certain things. I may be ashamed that I believe certain things. I may wish to God I didn't believe certain things. Yeah, ducktastic. That is fun. Thanks, Joe. But that is the first thing. And the reason that that's critical, I mean, there's a lot of reasons it's critical. I just have to first convince my bank to believe that I have $1 million to send you, and then it'll come right on its way. There's a lot of reasons that's important, but one of them is that it means you cannot. It just doesn't make any sense to approach questions of belief through a language of obligation, of required or prohibited, right? You cannot require people to believe that God exists any more than you can require them to be 90 feet tall or to be 4'7" or, you know, to have green eyes or to have been born on a Tuesday, right? You can't do it. And you can't prohibit people from thinking certain things. I mean, you can tell them that they ought not to, but the human will stops up short of its capacity for belief. And the reason that's important is for, I want to think of what we often call a correspondence theory of truth, that our ideas somehow match the world outside of us, right? The world outside of us, kind of its definition being outside of us, is it exists independent of my will. That's what makes it not me, right? Like that house across the street is across the street. I can't will it to be anywhere else. Now, maybe I could undertake some steps, but I can't just change that its location by force of will. So it better be that my belief about where it is also can't be transformed by my force of will. Otherwise, there's not much shot at my belief matching the world, if that makes sense. So that's number one. So that means that among one of the many things it means is that a halachic framework or a normative framework is not the right place to start. It's not the right place to move through. And it's not the right place to end. right? We will not be talking about what one ought to believe, what one needs to believe. And to the extent that you feel that, I want you to push hard to keep it at bay. And we might talk a lot about what we want to believe, what we desire to believe, what we yearn to believe, the beliefs we flee from or that dog us. But that is the first move. Okay. The second is a move I want to make, which is in a similar, which is against the assumption that the idea that belief is a kind of knowledge. Yigdal is only a song. Well, Yigdal is a lot more than a song. We'll spend some time on Maimonides, especially on the Thursday classes all about Maimonides. I would say it's a song, but not only. Songs are big. It's a compliment for a piece of literature to be a song. What I mean by that is we assume, right, you to believe something means to assert that a fact is true. Right? I believe that today is Wednesday. I believe that I can see, you know, there's someone named Mike Backfield on this call, et cetera. That is one way of thinking about belief, but it's not the only one. And here, the history of the Hebrew language is very helpful. The later strata of Hebrew, from, say, kind of late rabbinic on, operate the way through the root for belief, aleph, mem, nun, amen, laha amin, is followed by a shin, laha amin sh, to believe that. But the earlier strata of Hebrew, lahamin is followed by a bet, to believe in, to trust would be the cognate, to rely on, to have confidence in. Now, those are not mutually exclusive, but if you want to see someone go wild with this, the place to go is Martin Buber's Two Types of Faith, where he argues that in the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Luke, right, they're... Jesus asks his followers for trust. And then in John, which starts with the word, Jesus has transformed into a figure who demands belief that. And Buber actually thinks this is the break between Judaism and Christianity philosophically, that the early Jesus is Jewish and the late Jesus isn't. So that is, here's one way that might play out, right? If you believed that belief were a set of assertions or denials, you would say, oh, I could give Cheryl Shulman or Carol Koenig or Augusto or Lawrence or Joe Gindy or anyone else on this call, or all everyone on this call, a Scantron test with something like Yigdal, which I read a reference, right? Do you believe in God? Yes, no. Do you believe there'll be a resurrection? Yes, no. Do you believe that God controls events? Yes, no. Do you believe that the Torah is given on Mount Sinai? Yes, no, right? And if I, you know, I could just match everyone up who gave the same pattern of yes and no's, and they would have the same religious life. Now, I want to give you an example of how wrong that is. and I'm going to give you two kind of depictions of people, one of whom is me. It won't be hard to guess which one. Right. So one person grew up in an environment of lawyers, doctors, engineers, academics, and you know, a highly rationalized world. And they basically like, yeah, you know, the kind of regnant idea is that everything is atoms, quarks bouncing off each other, but there's something that makes the rumor of angels plausible that doesn't seem quite right. Capacity to love and to laugh and to remember and to fear death. There's something beyond those quarks, but I can't quite tell you what it is, or even if it's a who, and if it is a who, much less who it is. But if you woke that person up at 2 a.m, shook them, said, okay, yes or no. Is there a being named God with consciousness? That person probably put no on their Scantron. Person number two grew up in a very, very religiously conservative, one you might call from the outside, fundamentalist place. They were distrustful of certain authorities. They felt like authority was sometimes abused. They ultimately made the painful decision, costly decision to break with that community, to leave it. And as part of creating a new life and taking on responsibility for their choices, the kind of final step was to say, you know, there is no God who is directing my life. I am. And that person now triumphantly, when you give them the Scantron test, bubbles in no for the God. But I want to suggest to you that the meaning of those two no answers is vastly different, right? The stories behind them, the emotions behind them, you know, what it means to say no is very different. And that's because belief is not just the yes or no, it's everything around it. And we'll see actually Chasvei Kreskes, one of the great medieval Jewish philosophers, articulates this idea quite succinctly. That was number two, about thinking about and kind of living through belief in a way that's much richer than assertions and denials. And the last one is, I think, the most unintuitive, and it's really going to lead us in to today's sources and probably next week also. I'm going to say this with a big smile to help the shock of it go down a bit easier. I think an assumption that we operate with that is wrong is that religion is in the God business. And what I mean by that is that the assumption that the more one believes in God, experiences God, is certain of God's existence, the better and fuller a religious life a person will have. Conversely, the more doubts, fears, anxieties, reservations one has about God, the thinner or worse or harder or impoverished a person's religious life will be. And I am going to try to make the claim over the next, we have a little over half an hour, that this assumption is wrong. That actually some of the most influential and important and beautiful, specifically rabbinic passages, take doubt and uncertainty and distance and alienation and anger and disbelief as their starting place. And as the starting place of a religious life, one ought to begin there. That is the business that religion is in. One who has certainty about God maybe is doing something very nice, but it's not really rabbinic Judaism. So are you ready? That's a big claim I've made kind of in the history of ideas. What you're seeing here before you, you'll notice, is not just a source sheet with source, but there's a lot of explanation. The connective tissue is visible here. And the reason, the idea behind this experiment, which I hope you'll give me feedback on, and I trust you'll give Esther feedback on, which will get to me, is to democratize the learning process of it, right? So rather than me being the one who holds all the cards and only knows how to get from A to B, I want to lay out my thinking there. So in case you're, you know, spacing out while I'm saying something, or you're a visual learner, or you just want to read ahead or read back, you have the capacity to do that. You're not waiting for me to reveal the meaning or interrelation of the text. So that is the experiment. So you have that there. We're going to scroll through. If you could go to the second page now, Esther. Here we are. I'm going to ask people to read, just because I'm tired of my own voice. Max, I see you on my screen. Would you be up for reading this little section of Bereishit Rabbah, the early, right, 3rd century Palestinian rabbinic commentary on the beginning of Parshat Lech Lecha? And the question, which is, I would say, certainly A, and perhaps the question, right, is what is the backstory to God's saying to Avram, go forth, Lech Lecha? Why and how did God come to know Avram, and why and how did Avram become the type of person who could know and heed God's word? So we get one of the answers, and certainly the most famous and influential one in the tradition.
Okay. Rabbi Yitzchak said, a parable of a man who was passing from place to place and saw a burning apartment building. He said, you say this building has no manager? The owner of the building peered down at him and said to him, I am the owner of the building. So Abraham, our father, peace be upon him, would say, could you say that this world has no manager? The Holy Blessed One peered down at him and said to him, I am the owner of the world.
So we have here a parable, as the next source we'll read as well is, and it's one of the great ones. And the image is of a person walking through the world and they see an apartment building on fire. And this is a metaphor for the world, as becomes explicit in the second thing. So now there are readings of this that say an illumined castle, and those are wrong. It's tempting to read it as an illumined castle for a lot of reasons, but one of which I want to point out is there is a religious life in which religion starts from seeing the world full of beauty and order, the spirituality of sunsets, the arc of history bending towards justice. you know, the capacity of the humans to communicate, our bodies to function, and on and on. That's a real type of spirituality. And it's actually the one of Philo and Josephus, right, the pre-rabbinic Jewish voices that we have records of in their depictions of Abraham, of Avram, and how he eventually set on the path to become Avraham. And this Midrash rejects that and says the experience of walking through the world is, to use the idiom of our day, to experience the world as a dumpster fire. Right? Now, as a former New Yorker, I want to find there's something that's just the best about an apartment building as a metaphor for the world, right? It's this very large structure that allows different families who probably don't like each other that much, and certainly would, if they could, live very far away from the other people, coexist and get on. Yes, Heschel does read them both ways. And Heschel is not the first person. I mean, the tradition of reading it in the pushing in the illumined direction is ancient. I'm not ancient, it was medieval. I'll upload it to the Google folder. There's a great article by a teacher, Professor Pinchas Mandel, where he makes this point extensively. First of all, if the word doleket here means illuminated rather than aflame, this is the only place in rabbinic literature where it means that, right? It's about as close as you can. I mean, it's saying that it doesn't mean that. And the second thing, which is very interesting, this term manhig, thank you. This term manhig is a Hebrew translation of the Latin term conducto, who was the superintendent, lease officer, and fire marshal of these, what was called an incluso, which is translated in Hebrew here as birah, which was the Latin term for a five-ish story apartment building, which is very common in this section of the Roman Empire, you know, around the third century. So the kind of beautiful tour de force that Mandel does, it really shows that this is the reading. So that's the first thing. The place that this, the experience that this goes out of is an experience of not just the world being a dumpster fire. That was an imprecise and incomplete formulation. This is not a question. The question that the passerby / Avram asks is not one of theodicy. It's not why are there fires. It's not who allowed this to start. It's why aren't these people getting there? Why isn't there anyone who's organizing these people to put this out? Now, I can't help but think about this. I imagine, you know, a couple dozen of you are like, it's really hard to think of a more apt image right now in a time of climate crisis. It's like, why can't we just get ourselves together to stop burning the place down? That's like the question. It's not like, why is this happening? Oh, woe is us. This is unfair. Wait for a little bit. It's like, why isn't anyone successfully pursuing the role or executing the role? In Avram's example, it seems like no one's even trying. I mean, we have a lot of people trying, thank God. Hopefully they/we will succeed. But the picture is, why isn't anyone running the show? Why isn't anyone getting these people together to address the shared things that will bring them all down, right, across their family differences? The owner doesn't say, I'm the owner. He says, I'm the owner. I think by implication, as does Mandel think, would you please be the manhik, the conductor, the organizer? So if you wanted... If, as I know some of you are, you're in search of a text, the meaning of being a Jewish person and being in covenant with God is to organize humanity to address our shared threats, shared failings, you could not ask for a better passage than this, because that is exactly what it says. That's the charge that God gives Avram. You know, to just point out here, and we'll see the Maimonides try to pull away from this and Kreskos pull him right back to it. This is not a simple or easy place to start. This is not, you know, I was walking around and saw things that were beautiful. That's exactly what Maimonides will describe in a second. This is something different, something much more charged, something darker, something scarier. And there's a feeling, there's an experience basically of deep paradox, right? The apartment building seems to have been designed by someone with a lot of effort and expense went into it to making a habitable place. And yet, incomprehensibly, this place and its inhabitants are being allowed to die. You know, gruesome, undignified, and unnecessary death. And it's in that incomprehensibility, that perplexity, as Maimonides would call it, that the passerby cries out, and then God answers. So Shoshana, you posted the Mandel article. Would you read this passage from the Mishnah Torah where Maimonides describes, Avraham actually is using some of the language from this passage, the Manhig Conducto image, and very much going in the illumined palace direction.
Once this remarkable one, Avraham, was weaned, he began to explore in his thoughts even while he was young. He would think day and night, wondering, how is it possible that this orb moves constantly, noheg tamid, without a mover, manhig, or one who causes it to rotate? It is impossible for the orb to rotate itself. He had no tutor, and no one explained anything to him. He was stuck in Or Kasdim among the ignorant idolaters. Everyone was an idolater, including his mother and his father, and he practiced idolatry with them. That's a little bit better. But his mind explored and acquired understanding to the point where he grasped the way of truth, and he knew the true line, Kav HaTzedek. With his correct understanding, and he knew that there was one God who moves, Manhig, the orb, and that it created everything, and that there is no other God than it. And he knew that the rest of the world was mistaken, and that the thing that had caused them to err was the worship of the stars and the forms, to the point of the truth perishing from their thoughts. It was at the age of 40 that Abraham came to recognize Hakir, his creator.
Very nicely read. So this is Maimonides, and we're talking about the 12th century, and in the Mishnah Torah, and he recounts a version of this in the guide as well. Picture of Avram as an autodidact, and here Maimonides is consciously or not resurrecting the tradition of Philo and Josephus, getting back to Avram as an astronomer. A pious astronomer, rather than a horrified social observer, an actor, right? There are no human beings, other human beings. I mean, there are other human beings in this, but only in the sense that they're ignorant and get in the way of true understanding, right? They're not objects of care or concern or partners in potential solidarity, right? That they kind of exist as the background from which Avram extracts himself in relationship to the heavens, the illumined palace far away. It couldn't be more different in so many ways. And Crescas, we'll get to in a second, and I'm going to ask my mother-in-law, who's the daughter of a once Crescas scholar, to read this next passage. Rabbi Chassid Crescas kind of attacks Maimonides very, very aptly based on our Midrash from above. So I want to show you, just to be clear, Maimonides is in the God business, right? Maimonides is of the belief, it's the very opening of the Mishnah Torah, that knowledge of, in the sense of certainty about God, is at the foundation of a religious life, in some sense of a human life. And that's the picture he gives of Avram, very much the opposite of where I've been trying to take us. He's the foil here. So I want to tell you a little bit about who Chassid Crescas was in his work. So Crescas lived from 1340 to 1410 in Spain. And his great book, Or Hashem, is structured, completely unique structure among medieval, any really Jewish philosophical work. So to understand it, you need to understand a little bit about the structure of the guide, which was the greatest philosophical work in Jewish circles, period, and still is. The opening of the second section of the guide lists 26 principles, conclusions, of Aristotelian physics and metaphysics that Maimonides asserts are true. And then the first 17 or so chapters of section 2 of the guide combine these 26 principles in different ways to produce 6 different proofs of God's existence. So Crescas devotes the first section of his book, the first of 4 sections, to an interrogation of each of these 26 principles. That's why when Harry Wolfson translated this first book, he called it Crescas's Critique of Aristotle's Metaphysics. So Crescas, for each one, he gives the different formulations of the principle that have been given, the arguments for, the arguments against, and he supplies original arguments for and against, and then he renders his verdict as to whether or not the principle is true. And he thinks about half of the principles have been proven true, about a quarter have been proven false, and a quarter we're not sure. And then he uses that critical project that he's just undertaken to demolish all of Maimonides' proofs for God's existence, which Kreskes thinks to be an important project. Much later, Ludwig Wittgenstein, great 20th century philosopher, described his philosophy, said the purpose, if you could just turn off the screen share for a second, Shoshana, we'll go right back in. I'm sorry, Esther, we'll go right back in. There we go. He said, you know, the purpose of my philosophy is to burn down the house of cards that has been built by earlier philosophy so that something of value that will endure can be built in its place. But right now it's just taking up space and distracting people. And that's something like what Kreskes did. So then I'll just share the structure of the rest of the book because it's so great. The second section of four is the set of things that are in modern Kantian terminology analytic to the Torah. And those are the kinds of things that would have to be true for anything like the Torah to get off the ground. There has to be a God who knows particulars. Otherwise, how would God know which mountain is Sinai to land on? Human beings have to have some moral responsibility for our lives. Otherwise, the whole project of commandedness wouldn't make sense, right? There's a few of, you know, different ones like this. The human beings and God have to be able to communicate in some way, shape, or form. That's for anything, the Torah, the Quran, the Gospel, the Veda, whatever, anything like that would have to have these kinds of, so those are, these things are six of those. Great. Section three is about the things that the Torah teaches that are true, but it could have gone different ways. These are the particular content of Judaism. God hears prayer. You can imagine a God who isn't interested in prayer, right? There's something special about the land of Israel. You could imagine land not being special or different places of land being special, right? This is the distinctive content, right? God forgives. You could imagine a God who doesn't forget, right, et cetera. Great. But then things get really fun in section four, where Kreskes lists, I think it's 13 or 14, religiously important questions that we don't know the answer to. Things like, are we reincarnated? And everyone's favorite, is there intelligent extraterrestrial life in which God has covenantal relationships? And for each of these, Kreskes kind of musters the arguments for and against, including Talmud, and says what he thinks is more likely. So for that one, he says, well, first of all, why would an infinite God just pick one planet? That doesn't make sense. And secondly, there is this midrash that talks about what God does with God's day. It's the first part studying Torah, but then part of it visiting 24,000 worlds. Kreskes says, oh, maybe there's 24,000 other worlds on which God is in covenantal partnership with the whole species, a subset of the species, like the Jews. Like, but, you know, obviously we don't know. So he ends it there. So it's kind of, it's probably the one of the great pieces of Jewish science fiction. It's either there or is waiting to be written from there. So that's just the kind of person he was, right? And he's not these kind of gradations of levels of certainty. We're like the critical thing. So with all of that as backdrop, what we're about to read is the very, very conclusion of that first book. So remember, what he's just done is demolished all of Maimonides' as proofs for God's existence, which he thinks is valuable, right? He thinks that was a good thing that he did, right? It's not like the more certainty we have, the better off we'll be. He thinks it's important to be right. And actually being right means in some very profound sense being uncertain. So now, Esther, if you would reshare the screen.
Yeah, I'm just a little confused, Jason. So if you, in Maimonides, he believed that half of them proofs were correct. Isn't that what you said?
Ah, good. So there are 26 statements. You know, Maimonides thought, for example, there is no such thing as infinity because Aristotle thought that. So that becomes important actually in some of the proofs because you could, it says, you know, if there's no initial point, then there'd be an infinite regress of causes. You know, what happened yesterday caused what happened today, what happened 2 days ago caused what happened yesterday. But since by, I don't know, proposition number 19, we can't have an infinite, there's no such thing as infinity. And therefore we can't have an infinite regress of causes. Therefore, there must be a first cause who is God. So the different propositions of which there are 26 lead to the six proofs of God's existence. Kreskes attacked various of the 26, but there's no proof that survives because all, you know, if a proof involves seven or eight, the combined different ways, all that has to happen is one of them, not just to shift into the false, but shift into the realm of the unproven. if that makes sense. And interestingly, in the history of philosophy, Kreskes is actually the first Western philosopher to argue for the coherence of the concept of infinity in a way that contemporary philosophers endorse. Like really interesting figure. So that I picked that one not at random. Okay, Safda, take it away.
Here, i.e. in book one, it has been demonstrated that the principle of prophecy is what has enlightened our eyes on the road we are traveling in verification of these three roots, the existence, unity, and incorporeality of God in a perfect manner. And it has also been proved that rational speculation, ha'iyun, does not oppose it, but agrees with it from all sides, as is the nature of truth, that it is its own witness and agrees from every side.
So this is important, just to pause. What he said here is that we learn that God exists not from philosophy, but from the Torah, revelation. But this is critical. Philosophy doesn't disprove God's existence, right? It's, in the precise sense of the term, agnostic vis-a-vis God, and that to the extent we know who God is, that comes from our tradition, not from the general parameters of human reason. Okay, that's so far so good. And now he's going to bring us back to our Midrash of the Illumined Palace. I'm sorry, of the burning apartment building.
How appropriate to this is what our sages have said in the Midrash, a parable of a man who was passing from place to place and saw a burning building. He said, "Could you say this building has no manager, manhig?" The owner of the building peered down at him and said to him, "I am the owner of the building." Although he, Abraham, had an inclination toward the truth, Nitiya el Ha'emet, he did not escape all doubt until he caused his light to overflow upon him, which is prophecy.
So Kreskes has made a very subtle and very trenchant observation here about the difference between the Avram of the Midrash and the Avram of Maimonides. The Avram of Maimonides thinks his way to God unilaterally. He thinks about the orbs, he thinks a lot for a lot of years, and he follows the Kav HaTzedek, the line of truth, back to God. You almost imagine there's a rope dangling, and he just climbs really high, hand over hand, and he gets there. And the implication, and that Avram was living among ignorant idolaters and had no teacher, and he did it, and therefore you can too. Right? There is a capacity for certainty about God, which is accessible to every human being. We ought to have it, right? And Maimonides was not a doxastic voluntarist, but he thought if you pursued the proper course of study, you would come to the correct conclusion, which is that God exists. And Kreskes points out that that is not how this Midrash reads. Avram, the passerby, is walking around, and he doesn't know, it's hard not to use profanity here, he doesn't know what the is going on. Like, this doesn't make any sense. This is crazy pants. And then God says, "Let me tell you what's what." And the claim is, Kreskes' claim, which is the Midrash's claim, is that if you are a wise and open-minded human being, you will walk around the world really confused. And not quite in a sense of agnosticism, like, I don't know. You'll be like, there are certain things in the world that really push towards theism. Like the fact that I exist, and you exist, and like, Jews have made it through this time, and like, human beings can communicate, and we love, and we can understand the world. Like, that all doesn't make sense randomly. And i.e. it's an apartment building. And there are other things that really push hard in the direction of atheism. Like, this is just crazy. We're just violent super monkeys, you know, bouncing around this like pretty boring star. And it's all going to be forgotten in the annals of increasing entropy when Hubble expansion deal with it, right? Like, that's also there. And the Kreskes' picture is like, what it means to walk around the world as a human being is to have both of those. Like, this is a great apartment building, and it's really messed up, it's on fire. And then, if you're a prophet, which, by the way, none of us are, you will get a revelation that tells you which one of those is right. But until and unless you do, the proper cognitive and emotional and religious state is to be really confused and torn in different directions. And that's as far as a human being can go. So if you think that you have certainty about God's existence, you're either a really bad philosopher or you're lying to yourself. Like, those are the options. But the idea is, like, let's get clear that we're all really, really perplexed and stressed out. And then, okay, and then the Torah actually has something to tell us. Like, hey guys, I have something to tell you that's not obvious. You, like, God exists and loves you and cares about you, and your lives have meaning. Like, wow, that's a big message. It doesn't, and this is critical, right? It doesn't fully accord with my experience. That message is in certain ways, like the rumor of angels, dissonant. Right? Kreskes actually would say to be a traditional Jewish person is to have heard a rumor of angels. Now, he has a lot of faith in that tradition, and he makes arguments about why he thinks it's right, and et cetera. And tradition was a more reliable category in 1390 than it is in 2022 for all kinds of reasons. That is the argument, right, of kind of tech. Now, there's a lot more here. So I just want to go back to Kreskes's picture here, which is the Midrash's picture, and ask you all to try it on for size. The idea, basically, again, just to summarize, is that we, as people reflecting on our own experiences, really don't know what to make of this life. Like, maybe it's meaningful, maybe it's not. Maybe we shall be nihilists. And then, and he says, there is a divine call into the world, which Avraham had directly and we have indirectly from him, which puts its thumb down on the scale of life being meaningful in ways that affirm certain things we know and in ways that are reject certain things we might also kind of more or less know to be true. And we're asked to kind of trust in that, or at least be open ourselves to it. And so I want to ask you if that rings true. And the claim here, again, is that this is I'm trying to, in case this wasn't clear, kind of fight off any bullies you have, like mentally lurking behind you, saying, like, you ought to believe this, you ought to know, you shouldn't have doubt. You should. So like, no, they're like, you know, I'm like the teacher on the playground being like, you kids are not following the rules. Or like you go and time out. Like, the people have doubts are following the rules. You keep, go back to playing tag. But I want to invite you all to try it on. So Crystal, you have your hand up. Go for it.
What you're proposing is not all that radical to me and my thoughts. Part of the reason I came to Judaism, I grew up in a very, very traditional Christian household. And I even made it all the way up to earning a Master of Divinity. And pretty much my constructive theology paper says, I don't believe any of this. And I don't know what I believe. And I don't know what's real. And that's kind of been my mental state for a few years now. I don't know what's real, but there's a glimmer of something somewhere. And I just kind of look at the glimmer and I appreciate the glimmer of something pretty and divine or whatever. And I kind of go, okay, that's cool. And I kind of just go on with it. And I don't. So, yeah. So the idea of, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's real. And yes, there is that voice that's like, you should believe this, and you should, because I grew up with that voice. I grew up with a lot of those voices. But for me, the idea of, I don't really know what's up is not all that foreign.
Great. So we have, I have one who's Abby, and then Nina. I'll put the names in the chat, Shoshana, Carol, and Ted. And I see we have 6 minutes left and five people. So if each person takes approximately a minute, and I'll try to put a bow on everything at the end. We have a bunch of really interesting chats coming also.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around what maybe a shot of this Midrash and what you said earlier about, if I understood correctly, about Avraham or the human in this story having responsibility to put out the fire, to take action. I just don't see that. And I wanted clarification on that. And I'll just try and say one more very brief thing, that it's not clear to me when this burning apartment building is there, both Avraham and God seem to me to be saying, like, they seem to be throwing their hands up in the air. Like, on the one hand, Avraham is like, well, God says, he says, isn't anybody responsible for this? And then God says, I'm responsible for it, but there's no action that's being taken. So
this is where kind of social role is helpful in two ways. One is, you know, if there's a burning apartment building and I walk into the apartment building and start telling people what to do, it's not clear that they are going to listen to me, or even should listen to me, right? And that's the role of the conducto manhiga, someone whose job and kind of authority and expertise and responsibility is to organize the people to effectively fight or at least survive the fire. And there's no one performing that role. Where's the fire department? And then the second thing, which this is something else Mandel plays off of, is that almost all of the apartment buildings in Roman Palestine were owned by absentee landlords, mostly living in what we would call Italy today. So when God says, I'm the owner, the owner can't help, separated by like 1,000 kilometers of salt water. So it's not so much, and that's actually a radically limited picture of God, right? God actually needs a human agent. Just like, you know, your management company that's managing 600 apartment buildings like needs someone on the ground. Whether to call it a passivity, I think assumes a certain amount of agency, but it's actually a much more limited God. I think there's something much more familiar about the biblical kind of orientation to time and the miraculous than to us. And here's an example of that, right? We live in a world where like, okay, we live in a very rational present with the iron cage of causality and natural law. But we think back in the day, they lived in a more enchanted world where there were, you know, fairies and miracles, et cetera. So it turns out that if you're a reader of the Bible, there's a watershed moment around Genesis chapter 10. Because prior to Genesis chapter 10, God can and does change the way the world works. If you show up and you see a snake with legs, you know you're in the first two chapters. If the snake doesn't have legs, you're from chapter 3 on. If there are no rainbows, you're in the first 5 chapters, right? If there are rainbows, you're chapter 5 and on. After Genesis chapter 10, if there's only one language that everyone speaks and understands, you're in the first 8 chapters, right? If there are multiple languages, you're chapter 9 and on. No miracle of the type of changing the way the world works ever happens again in the Bible from chapter 10. And so that means if you're one of the initial recipients of the Bible, it is inviting you to imagine that there was an earlier time in the deep past when things were more enchanted. The laws of nature changed more. God was more active. Now, okay, maybe the sea splits, but it looked the same before and after. There are temporary aberrations, but there was a time back when things were much wilder. And it's a little bit shocking to us, actually, to me at least, that kind of basic structure of a consciousness of modernity, which means now, nowness, right? That now is different, where there's less divine presence in the world, is than a back then that I remember and I have texts from, even though that memory is kind of created from the text, is exactly the way the Bible imagines time, and presumably its first readers did as well, right? Because we think of that as a feature of our now, our present. It wasn't the way it used to be flat. In the past, it was all enchanted until Voltaire came along and Newton proved Kepler's laws using, universal gravitation, and boom. Well, the Dasna, great example. What about the mana? But there's no mana in the desert right now. It happened for a few years and then it stopped. There's never, the laws of nature are the same, it seems, as they were for Moses.